Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the latest news from Wisconsin with the recall elections that may be a bellwether for national political trends in the coming election year. John Nichols, the nation's Washington editor and the associate editor of the Capital Times in Madison, Wisconsin, joins us. Then we will speak with Dahlia Lithwick, who is a contributing editor at Newsweek and a senior editor at Slate. She covers the Supreme Court and judicial issues, and we will discuss recent rulings that might put Donald Rumsfeld and, by extension, Dick Cheney in jeopardy for their role in encouraging the use of torture. Then finally, we'll examine the shocking growth of homelessness and hunger amongst America's children, outlined in the State of America's Children 2011, a recent report by the Children's Defense Fund. We will talk with one of the report's authors, Mary Lee Allen, who is Director of Child Welfare and Mental Health at the Children's Defense Fund. Joining us now from Wisconsin is John Nichols, who is the nation's magazine's Washington correspondent. He's also the associate editor of the Capital Times, the daily newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin. He and Rob McChesney co-authored It's the Media, Stupid, and Tragedy and Farce, How the American Media Still Sells Wars, Spins Elections, and Destroys Democracy. He also wrote The Rise and Rise of Richard B. Cheney and Dick, the Man Who Is President, Dick Cheney. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Nichols.
It's a pleasure to be on with you. How are you doing?
Very well, and I guess you're doing okay. It's a mixed result here. If you were hoping that the governor of Wisconsin, Scott Walker, would be completely repudiated, it didn't quite happen. Democrats won two of the Wisconsin State Senate seats in yesterday's recall election. So where does that place these very polarized politics in this important bellwether state?
It keeps them just about as polarized as they've been, and you've got this kind of brutal, ongoing battle between a Democratic Party that, because of recent developments, has become much more closely aligned with organized labor and the progressive movement. You know, you have Democrats now finishing their rallies raising clenched fists, and a Republican Party that, again, because of recent developments, has become much more aligned with, much more in sync with the Tea Party right and a lot of the conservative, really kind of core conservative movement, as well as the conservative billionaires who fund a lot of them. So the state's very divided. The recalls did not give you, you know, sort of that transformative moment where power is shifted and everything changes. But it's very important to recognize that, you know, we have a real problem in America. We tend to cover our politics as winner-take-all, that you just have to have a result, and that's all there is. Sometimes there's subtlety in a result that matters much more than is initially apparent. The Republicans lost two seats. That means that they now have a 17-16 majority in the very powerful state Senate of Wisconsin. But there is one maverick Republican who has sided with the Democrats on labor issues, on the core issues of this fight, collective bargaining, as well as on public funding and local services issues. This is a guy named Dale Schultz from a rural district in southwest Wisconsin. That maverick Republican now has the ability to say to his own caucus, you can't do this anymore. You cannot take away labor rights. You can't do a right-to-work bill, because if you do, I'll side with the Democrats on that issue. It's going to create a much different dynamic in the Capitol. So beneath the surface of this election, we have a shifted reality politically and policy-wise. And beyond that, we also have, because there are going to be two more recall elections next week, an intense focus on those elections, because Republicans are going to try and beat at least one Democratic senator so they're not stuck in this situation of having to deal with their maverick member.
So, John Nichols, given what's happened at the national level in Washington, D.C. recently, where it should be apparent to all that the far right of the Republican Party is running the party and that they've captured national policy and moved the country to the right. So are you saying that in Wisconsin we are witnessing the first pushback, because there is, at a national level, no apparent pushback from the left or the Democrats? So that's something that I find extraordinary, that the far right has captured American politics and the left is almost not showing up.
Moribund, yeah. So, yes, I will absolutely say that we have seen dramatic pushback in Wisconsin, and we've seen it in the right way. It hasn't just been electoral. There's, you know, media loves to focus on elections because they're so easy to cover. You have a date, you kind of have all sorts of intensity, and then on a certain night at a certain time, everything's settled, you can go on vacation. The reality of politics is it plays out at many levels. It plays out on the streets. It plays out in the halls of government. It plays out at polling places. In Wisconsin, you've seen that sort of multi-tiered politics, which is a much healthier, much more small-d democratic reality. And so we have had mass demonstrations, some of the largest pro-labor demonstrations in the history of the republic, 180,000 people out on one Saturday in March. We have had the largest number of legislative recalls ever in the history of the republic. You've never had nine of them in one summer, as we're facing right now. And again, that's a small-d democratic response. Two of these recall elections have seen members of the governor's party defeated within months after he was elected by a rather comfortable margin. That is a setback. And we have more coming, more recalls, more possibility, at least, of a recall of the governor himself, and sort of an intense politics. Literally, Ian, when I walked down the street in Madison just 20 minutes ago before doing this interview, I walked by, there was a huge labor rally where the unions that represent state employees are having people sign up to pay their dues. Their dues checkoff is going to be lost as part of the governor's attack on them, but people are signing up, you know, affirmatively to say, I still want to be in the union, I still want to pay my dues. There were hundreds of people out doing this. And so you're seeing a mobilization and a political activism that I think many of us who've covered politics have long wondered, you know, when was that going to happen? Where was that going to happen? It is happening in Wisconsin, but it's a hard fight because just labor and progressives are out there working very hard, doing, you know, incredible stuff. You also have the wealthiest people in America, billionaires, they're saying that their top priority is to maintain Republican power in Wisconsin, flooding money into the state, just financing incredible campaigns. And so everything's turned up, and that's just the reality of the state at this point.
Again, I'm speaking with John Nichols, who is the Nation Magazine's Washington correspondent and associate editor of Madison, Wisconsin's Capital Times. We're talking about yesterday's recall elections in which two Republican senators were defeated. And as John Nichols said, there's one Republican senator who sometimes wavers, and that could bring it to a 16-16 stalemate?
It could give the Democrats a majority. Not that this guy's not going to switch parties.
No.
But on issues, if he sides with the Democrats will have a 17-16 majority.
I see.
Significance of these two seats flipping is that it has put Democrats within the range. Let's put it another way. If we jettison partisan politics and we just imagine a kind of a left and a right or a pro-labor, anti-labor, we now have, because of these elections yesterday, a pro-labor majority in one of the chambers of the Wisconsin legislature. We didn't have that, and so that's a dynamic that has shifted.
So there was one race where the Democrat Jessica King beat Republican State Representative Randy Hopper, and he only won by 163 votes last time. So that's not a big surprise. But race that a lot of people were watching, because the county clerk there, Kathy Nicholas, she botched the results of the state Supreme Court race in April, which opened up all kinds of questions, which still, I think, a lot of people find troubling. The Democrat lost there and then basically a charge that Nicholas had tampered with the results, a charge that she later kind of backed down from. Where does that stand?
Well, look, Kathy Nicholas, who is the Waukesha County clerk, as you mentioned, has had a steady pattern of botched elections, problematic elections, where she has held the results back until long after the polls were closed. Everybody else's votes are counted, but somehow in this very sophisticated suburban county, they don't have them. And then in some cases, turning up tens of thousands of votes 2 days after the election, she has had elections reversed because the counting was so badly done. She's been rebuked by her own county board, a conservative Republican county board, because she makes such a mess of it. And it's just almost beyond comprehension that we've had this happen again. And sincere people, serious observers of elections, are saying this can't be chance. I mean, it appears that this woman always seems to blow it when there's a critical election for the Republican Party, which she has been aligned with and worked with for a very long time. That's caused an immense amount of cynicism as regards her approach. It's caused a lot of anger. Congresswoman Tammy Baldwin, who represents the Madison area, in April sent a letter to the U.S. Department of Justice asking that they open an investigation of this clerk and her activities in Waukesha County. And I think that at this point, with another troublesome result, even if it didn't decide this race, another troublesome result, you really do get to that point where it would seem legitimate to have some outside entity come in and take a look at what is happening in what is, I would point out, one of Wisconsin's most populous counties. This is a big suburban county outside of Milwaukee that turns in a lot of votes. And if they can't run an election there, then we've got a big small-d democracy problem in Wisconsin.
But, John Nichols, is she incompetent or is she partisan?
Is she part of the machine?
Is she part of the Republican machine in delivering for them? This is not a case of serial incompetence. This is a case, you think, of partisan subversion of the process.
Well, I think what I will say is this. That's the question, incompetent versus part of the machine. My sense is that the pattern of her interventions raises legitimate questions about whether she is acting in a partisan manner, not in an incompetent manner, but in a partisan manner that benefits the people she has been politically aligned with for a long time. Those kinds of questions cannot exist in a functioning democracy. When the person who counts the votes is suspect, and not suspect just by you and I talking today, but an awfully lot of folks are troubled, including her own Republican county board expressing concerns, that's the point at which you really need to investigate and get to the bottom of it. And we don't need to make charges against this woman. What we need to do is figure out, what's going on. If she is incompetent, then she really should find something else to do with her time. She shouldn't be running elections. If she's not incompetent, if she's doing this for partisan reasons, then, she's doubly problematic and obviously would have to be removed.
Again, I'm speaking with John Nichols, who is the Nation Magazine's Washington correspondent and associate editor of Madison, Wisconsin's Capital Times. Just to get back to the national perspective, because this is a bellwether state and this is an early indicator of perhaps how things are going and perhaps whether or not there is a backlash. There's a general sense at the national level that the Republicans are in ascendancy and getting their way and driven by a small minority on the far right. They seem to be on a roll. And there is also a sense from the polls that the public is in general disgusted with Republicans and Democratic legislators. But that doesn't seem to be the case in Wisconsin. It sounds like there's some real political passions out there on the streets. And I understand that this recall movement didn't come from the legislators. It actually came from the people. Is that right?
I think there's no doubt of that. You can't recall someone in Wisconsin without having a mass of citizens who are engaged in the fight. Because to file those recall petitions, you've got to gather 25% of the voters in a district. It's a huge number of voters. And as a result, that requires you to have an army, a mass of folks who are going to go knock on doors, stand in front of grocery stores with their clipboards. I mean, this is real grassroots politics. And passions are very raw. They're very much on the surface. I was in a town, Portage, Wisconsin, yesterday afternoon, late in the afternoon, as the polls were getting toward closing. There was a line coming out of the polling place that stretched across a yard, across a parking lot. People were waiting as much as 45 minutes to an hour to vote. So people are taking this politics in this state very, very seriously. We don't have a disconnect there. But what we do have, and we've got to emphasize it, is we have an incredible overlay of out-of-state money, particularly corporate money freed up by the Citizens United ruling of the Supreme Court. And that is a warping factor. We cannot deny that, and I think it absolutely has an influence on how some of these races turn out, because while they may begin with grassroots democracy, people knocking on doors, people passing petitions, and from above they're pressed down upon, they're influenced by, and a lot of non-grassroots democracy, national political money coming from billionaire conservative donors like the Koch brothers, and that is a factor on the other side. So in a sense, we've got it all in play in Wisconsin, as we will in Ohio and several other states where some of these labor battles are going to be playing out as the fall goes on.
What has been Scott Walker's response to these results? How is he taking them?
You know, he's been relatively tame in his response. He's claimed a victory up to a point, but he understands the dynamic that is in play. What I said earlier in the interview about Dale Schultz, this maverick Republican, being very much in disagreement with the governor on some of the governor's core issues, education reform, privatization of schools, as well as the labor agenda issues, not just collective bargaining, but right-to-work laws and things like that. The governor knows that he is in a vulnerable place, and so he's going to wait for these two recall elections next week where Democratic senators face challenges to see, you know, really where he stands. As of right now, we still have a very volatile situation, even as regards control of the upper chamber of the legislature. And so, despite the fact that there's been some national coverage that suggests this is some sort of big victory for the governor, he recognizes he's still got some fights on his hands.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, John Nichols.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Ian. Great questions, and always glad to be with you.
Again, I've been speaking with John Nichols, who is The Nation magazine's Washington correspondent. He's also associate editor of the Capital Times, a daily newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin. He and Rob McChesney co-authored It's the Media, Stupid, and Tragedy and Farce, How the American Media Sells Wars, Spins Elections, and Destroys Democracy. He also wrote The Rise and Rise of Richard B. Cheney and Dick, the Man Who is President, Dick Cheney. We're going to take a station break and we'll be back talking with Dahlia Lithwick about Dick Cheney, the angler, and whether or not he will be jailbait.
Well, I'm going to tell you, fascists, you may be surprised. People in this world are getting organized. You're bound to lose. You fascists, bound to lose.
Woo! All you fascists, bound to lose.
I said,
all you fascists, bound to lose.
Yes.
All you fascists, bound to lose. You're bound to lose. You fascists, bound to lose.
Don't you know it was wrong? Cheat the trying men. Don't you know it was wrong to cheat the trying men? Don't you know it was wrong to cheat the trying men? Don't you know it was wrong to cheat the trying men? Someday you're gonna fall. Someday you're gonna fall.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. And this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Dahlia Lithwick, who is a contributing editor at Newsweek and a senior editor at Slate, where she specializes in covering the Supreme Court and judicial issues. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dahlia Lithwick.
Thank you, Ian. Thanks for having me.
It looks as though the angler, Dick Cheney, could be jailbait. You know, obviously there's a lot of people who feel that he's gotten away with too much and that George W. Bush got away with a lot. And there's been no punishment for essentially shaming the name of the United States, if you will, abroad. Clearly, there have been tremendous detriment to our foreign policy when dictators like Gaddafi and the current murderers in Syria and Mugabe in Zimbabwe can get away with murder and torture because they can always say, well, the United States does it, so what's your problem? I mean, there is a terrible stain, a permanent stain, that's affecting our foreign policy. So where do we stand in terms of whether or not there will be some accountability? Because it looks like our president is quite determined that there is no accountability.
Some developments in the last 2 weeks are really noteworthy. I mean, I think you're absolutely right. You know, the predicate question is, will there ever be anyone at the highest levels held responsible for, you know, the illegal torture program, illegal wiretapping and eavesdropping and all of the lawlessness of the Bush years? And I think the resounding answer to that has been no. And I think that the Obama administration has made it clear not just that they wouldn't hold the prior administration's feet to the fire, but that they would in fact obstruct the legal system from moving forward. And so they not only defended people like like Donald Rumsfeld or John Yoo or other architects of the torture program in court, but they invoke things like the state secrets doctrine, which is an attempt to get the whole lawsuit thrown out of court. So the Obama administration has not moved things forward at all. But there was a development in the recent weeks that is noteworthy, at least in terms of drawing attention to the issues. A federal court in Washington, D.C. decided last week, and then a federal appeals court based in Chicago from the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeal also decided this week that suits against Donald Rumsfeld, named personally for the torture program, could go forward. These suits could proceed to trial. This is a big deal because all of such suits, similar suits, have been thrown out prior to this. And so it really is, it's early days. The courts make no finding of fact. They're not making a judgment about what happened. But what they are doing, and what is dramatically different from what prior courts have done, is they're saying, you know what? There is enough merit to the claims in this suit that it can go forward and a jury can look at it or a judge can look at it and determine what happened. And that is, like I say, early days, but it is a big deal. And moreover, it's a big difference.
So let's talk about these two different suits, Dahlia Lithwick. The D.C. suit where Judge James Gwin ruled that citizens don't lose their constitutional rights simply because it's wartime, that involves a translator who claims to have been tortured by U.S. forces at Camp Cropper in Iraq. Now, is that person an American citizen?
He is, and he's a John Doe defendant. The court has granted him anonymity, so we don't know what his name is. That's different from, and I think I may have said the Fifth Circuit when I was speaking before. I meant the Seventh Circuit, which issued the judgment on Monday. That's different from the Seventh Circuit suit, where we know the names and the identities of the folks who were tortured. But yes, in all three suits, we're talking about American citizens working for the military toward the effort in Iraq. In the Washington, D.C. suit, he was a translator. The two who were working in the Chicago lawsuit were working as contractors, defense contractors in Iraq. So not only were they American citizens, arguably, they were trying to help the American side in the war effort.
Well, their story, Dahlia Lithwick, is just extraordinary. I mean, it really, here we are in Hollywood. I mean, this is a movie. You have these two fellows, a Navy veteran, Vance and Ertel, who are working for a defense contractor. And they became informants for the FBI because they saw all kinds of shady activity with illegal weapon sales, etc. And then their employers basically got wind of what they were up to. The military raided this company and hauled everybody off into custody. And suddenly these whistleblowers found themselves being treated as terrorists. And this brutal treatment went on for months and weeks in each case.
That's exactly right. I mean, this is a colossal screw-up. Because they were involved with this contractor Shield Group Security, when they were captured, initially rescued by the military, suddenly the allegation was, well, you're involved with them, therefore you must be part of their shenanigans. And both Donald Vance and Nathan Ertel kept saying, no, no, you don't understand. We're whistleblowers. We're involved with them because we couldn't know what we know if we weren't involved with them. One of the things that's problematic is that the military appears to have continued to hold Vance long after it became clear that they'd made a huge mistake. But yeah, the suit is based on the idea that their abuse, and it really looks to be horrific abuse, and the Seventh Circuit opinion goes into detail about how they were hooded, they were thrown into walls, allegedly they were treated to extreme cold temperatures, sleep deprivation, all the usual litany of the abuses we've seen with respect to enemy combatants, except of course they weren't enemy combatants, but they were treated to all those abuses. And the allegation here is that Donald Rumsfeld himself, acting in his capacity of defense secretary, authorized this maltreatment, and he personally should be on the hook in this civil suit.
Well, of course, I started the interview out by talking about Dick Cheney, which clearly we're talking about Donald Rumsfeld, but the reason I did is because they're joined at the hip, and I assume that if this case goes forward, that relationship between Rumsfeld and Cheney will come to the fore?
I think it's certainly the case that the hope is, and this is all the various lawsuits brought by the ACLU and other groups who are trying to find some accountability for those top officials in the Bush administration, that there is some hope that all of them get swept up in this and that they are all held to account. I want to be very careful to emphasize this is not a decision on the merits. This is the court saying two things. One, there is enough evidence that they have alleged sufficient facts that Rumsfeld personally can be liable, and two, he's not immune under this doctrine of immunity. But the court says that is assuming what the court has to assume for purposes of dismissing a suit, that everything that Vance and Ertel allege is the truth. So he's not saying it's the truth. He's saying, I won't throw it out if these things are true. So I think that it's fair to say, and there's one other thing that's so important, Ian. The other claims that Rumsfeld made in defense are very familiar to those of us who've been following these torture suits. One of them is, oh, it's not for the courts to interpose themselves into these military affairs, right? What do judges from far away know about what's happening in the battlefield? The judges made short work of that claim. And the other thing is this state secrets doctrine, which is what defendants in these torture suits continuously use and have very effectively used to get entire lawsuits alleging torture thrown out of court. The argument is, oh, the fact of our torture regime is such a secret that if it came out in court, it would harm national security. And even though that's a laughable proposition, we know everything we need to know about waterboarding, that has succeeded in claim after claim. So the court in this case said, nope, I don't accept that as a grounds for dismissing this suit. And so those are important chinks in what Rumsfeld and the Obama administration have been alleging to try to get the suits to go away. I don't know that this is going to be a successful suit down the line. I think where it's important is a national sense that these things are happening, that there may be consequences in court, that this occurred. It didn't just occur to someone in Iraq who was an enemy combatant waving a gun against American forces. This occurs to a Navy veteran who is in Iraq trying to help the country, doing the work of a whistleblower, and still he gets swept up in this. Those things were very, very important to the Court of Appeals, that this is Americans who should have civil remedies for torture when the American government tortures them. So I think that more than the efficacy of this suit, who knows where it's going to end up, is the drawing of attention to this principle that if we allow the government to torture people in secret at Guantanamo, it will bleed into how we treat Americans at home. And that is exactly what happened here.
Again, I'm speaking with Dahlia Lithwick, who writes about the Supreme Court and judicial issues for Newsweek and Slate. So the judge in this case involving the Navy veterans Vance and Ertel, his statement here is, this court was faced with a choice between protecting the most fundamental rights of American citizens in the difficult context of war or leaving those rights solely in the hands of politicians and the military. Now, that certainly does seem to resonate. Do you feel, Dahlia, that, you know, we're living in a political environment where the majority, we just learned that 82% of the American people are absolutely disgusted with the decisions just made by the Congress, this debt ceiling deal, and they feel that the Congress should be focused on creating jobs, not austerity. But the truth of the matter is, the majority of the people's voice doesn't seem to matter politically. Does it matter in terms of the judiciary?
It's a great question. I feel like torture is one of those examples of how we have developed a new normal in this country, and that which was shocking when we learned about it in Abu Ghraib is not just normalized, but somehow we've almost put some value on it so that, oh, you know, 10 years ago, if we thought about waterboarding, it was horrifying. Remember, you know, Americans have been opposed to waterboarding forever. We've prosecuted people for waterboarding in this country. It was unthinkable. And suddenly you get a sort of jokey, right, here's Dick Cheney describing it as a dunk in the water, John Yoo saying, oh, we only waterboarded 3 people, maybe it was worth it. So I think that it's quite the contrary, and I think public opinion polls suggest that Americans have actually become quite comfortable with with torture over 10 years. I hope I'm wrong about that. But it seems that public opinion has hardened to the point that we say, oh, well, in a ticking time bomb scenario, there's no such thing, by the way, but in one, certainly okay to torture, so maybe we should torture everybody all the time. And so I don't know that public opinion is hardened against torture. I do think that the courts have kept a real hands-off approach to all of these issues. I think that with the exception of a handful of Supreme Court decisions that laid out markers for how you can and can't treat detainees, the courts have really deferred, and this state secrets doctrine is a good example of that. When the government comes in and says, oh, well, we can't be on the hook for this in a court of law, the courts have tended to say, oh, you're right, we can't get into this, we have no expertise about this. So it seems to me what's changed, at least in the last couple of weeks, is courts saying, look, your claim in defending Donald Rumsfeld here is that even if everything that is alleged is true, everything that Vance and Ertel allege is true, the government still gets away with it. That's the defense here, and that's where Judge Hamilton balks here. That's where he says, I can't accept the proposition that fundamental constitutional rights of Americans are violated by Americans, and there's no recourse. So it seems obvious to us that that is a position judges should have been taking all along. What's dramatic is that judges have not taken that position. So as I say, it remains to be seen how this particular case and the case out of D.C. progresses. But I think it's important to see the judiciary finally say, I'm not going to be fobbed off with claims that we have no business interceding in this dispute. We have absolute business interceding when a constitutional right has been violated by Americans of Americans.
So, Dahlia Lithwick, how do you think the constitutional lawyer who now sits in the Oval Office would view this?
Well, as I said, I think one of the issues on which President Obama has been quite disappointing is accountability for the architects of some of the worst lawlessness in the Bush administration. I think, you know, he took a strong position against the state secrets doctrine, but has invoked it repeatedly once his Justice Department held the reins. He's taken a very strong position against torture for closing Guantanamo. On that, he was thwarted. On the closing of Guantanamo, he was thwarted. But certainly, I think as a constitutional lawyer, those of us who looked at him and said, here's somebody who understands deeply and fundamentally the violence that was done to the Constitution in the Bush era, he's going to fix it. I think that hasn't been the case. I think that he has this notion that we need to, his words, turn the page, move on, look forward, not backward, and not create some kind of witch hunt where we go after a handful of individuals for wartime decisions. And so I think it seems to me that that's been the position they've taken almost from the outset. And it seems to me that the problem with that analysis is that you can't move forward. You really can't move forward unless there's been some kind of reckoning with what happened before. And this president, admittedly very busy with other issues, with the economy, with the war, everything else, has just determined that moving forward on these issues is a pragmatic decision. It seems to me that the courts are not really in agreement with that posture.
But Dahlia Lithwick, the president clearly does have his hands full, but one of the reasons why he's losing ground and may lose the next election, particularly on the economy, is that he has not been able to reverse the economic illiteracy in this country, where the Republicans have been able to convince a majority of Americans that the deficit is the greatest problem, as opposed to economics 101 that tells you that during a recession, you have to prime the pump, not turn off the tap. And clearly Wall Street has repudiated what the Congress and the president have just signed off on, as we've noticed with the turmoil on the markets, that taking $2 trillion out of a sick economy is counterintuitive. So he's failed, I think, to make his own case. And I feel in many ways that we need not just a teachable moment on the economy, but also in terms of what you just said, which is that the majority of the American people do not understand how pernicious and damaging torture has been for the United States. And they've been sort of swept up in that Fox program 24, that notion of the ticking nuclear weapon, the car bomb, which of course is entirely in the realms of fiction.
I think that's not only right, but I think I would double down on that proposition and say not only have Americans been swept up in the idea that whereas torture was once unthinkable, now we make efficacy arguments about torture, right? Now we're saying, well, if it works, maybe it's okay. Whether it works or not is immaterial. We don't do it because it's illegal. It violates international conventions. It violates domestic law. It's been off the table for centuries. So the idea that now we're debating efficacy is really horrifying to me. But I would go one further and say, what happened when we captured Osama bin Laden and killed him a few months back, and the conversation very quickly became torture defenders saying, you see, we got him because we waterboarded. Because we waterboarded Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, we got a critical piece of information that led us years and years later to Osama bin Laden. Again, that's an efficacy argument. That's not an ethical argument. But more pointedly, and this is the thing I guess I really want your listeners to think about, the argument has changed from ticking time bomb, right? This is a guy who has critical information at this moment that could stop an imminent attack. Now we're being offered something called a mosaic theory, whereby something that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed didn't even say while being waterboarded, the allegation is it's something he didn't say while being waterboarded, was a critical piece of the puzzle, and that's enough to justify torture. So I just want to think about the slippage there. We've gone from torturing someone because they have all the information to stop an attack to torturing someone because someday something they don't say may or may not be a useful piece of a larger puzzle to get someone else. That's unbelievable. That is justification for torturing everyone you capture all of the time because they might say or not say something that may be useful in the future. That's where we are in the conversation about torture today.
Well, just a couple of minutes here at the end, if I may, to change the subject, because yesterday I spoke with the New Republic's John Judas, who has been covering the Romney campaign up in New Hampshire, and he made the remark that he thinks that this will be a one-term president, that that Obama will lose the next election. And, you know, that's obviously one person's speculation. But what would the impact be on the Supreme Court of a Republican presidency?
You know, it's so hard to know because we're really looking at 78-year-old Ruth Bader Ginsburg and saying, is she going to retire or is something going to happen to her? And that's ultimately between her and God Almighty. So it's very, very hard to know. I certainly think that we have a Supreme Court at this moment that is carefully balanced between four liberals, four conservatives, four extreme conservative, and one moderate but very conservative moderate Anthony Kennedy. I think it's going to be a game changer when Anthony Kennedy retires. That's when somebody has the opportunity to put in either a reliable liberal or a reliable conservative. And really, I think at that moment, tip the balance of the Supreme Court forever and for a long time. But I do think that it is the case that if Republican wins in 2012 and Ruth Bader Ginsburg retires, there is a strong possibility that that could happen early. But all eyes right now are on Anthony Kennedy, because I think if and when that retirement happens, that really is going to be thermonuclear confirmation process, where it's hard to imagine either side ever acceding to the other side's nominee. And I think we're going to see rock bottom ugliness in confirmation, which, as you know, is already a pretty despicable process. But I think it's going to get much worse when Anthony Kennedy, who really is the swing vote at the court, is in play. So really, I think in the near term, it's a question about Justice Ginsburg. She says she plans to stay on until Louis Brandeis's age when he retired, which is 83. But, you know, she has had two bouts of cancer. It's very, very hard to predict any of these things and quite macabre to even engage in it. But I think that certainly there is a distinct possibility of losing that fourth liberal voice at the court if something were to happen to her and a Republican were to win in 2012.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Dahlia Lithwick.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Dahlia Lithwick, who is a contributing editor at Newsweek and a senior editor at Slate, where she specializes in covering the Supreme Court and judicial issues. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about a new report, The State of America's Children, 2011. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Mary Lee Allen, who is Director of Child Welfare and Mental Health at the Children's Defense Fund. For more than two decades, Mary Lee Allen has played a leadership role in the development, passage, and implementation of major child welfare and children's mental health reforms. The Children's Defense Fund recently released their report, The State of America's Children, 2011. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mary Lee Allen.
Thank you.
And clearly, this idea that we have these appalling statistics relating to the poverty of children and the deprivation of children in the wealthiest country on the planet is shameful, but it seems particularly so in the context of what's happening with our national politics, where we have a successful movement in this country that's convinced the majority of the American people that we have to accept some austerity and cut back on traditional programs for the elderly, like Social Security and Medicaid. And the idea that we would be throwing our elderly into poverty when our children are already in poverty seems so counterintuitive. So give me a sense of what you feel that the response has been to this shocking report that you put out.
The Children's Defense Fund, State of America's Children 2011, really paints a devastating portrait, as you've mentioned, of children's needs across the country. And I think what is particularly significant about it is the fact that with rampant unemployment, housing foreclosures, homelessness and hunger, and then massive looming federal and state budget cuts, children's well-being is in great jeopardy. So we look at this whole range of data that looks from birth through children moving into adulthood, and at each of these points, we should be moving forward and advancing children's well-being, but instead, pressures, particularly at the federal level, but also in states, are moving us backwards in terms of children's needs. And therefore, we've got to change that national politic that you described. We've got to talk about people investing in children now so that as our workforce of the future, they'll be able to care for an aging generation. I think it's important, though, to keep in mind that the polling, some of the recent polling that's been done, really shows that the general public believes in the importance of investing in children. They do not want to see cuts in Medicaid, in education programs, in Head Start and others. They want to see us looking at the tax side of our agenda as well as the spending side of our agenda. I think what's so important when people look at this is they talk about deficits and they forget that deficits aren't only about spending. Deficits are about the gap between spending and revenues. And therefore, when we talk about investing in children, we've got to look at being able to continue to increase investments in Head Start and early childhood. At the same time, we cut back in tax breaks and closing loopholes for some of our richest Americans and corporations. And that's what we hope the State of America's Children can help to do, to say if we're serious about our future and our economic stability in the future, there are a number of areas where we need to invest.
But just to return to the idea that there's serious efforts afoot, some of which the President Obama apparently agreed to cut back on Social Security, the children today of the elderly would be bankrupt if they had to pay their parents' health care and nursing care in their old age, which is what Social Security does. And if you took it away, then the burden would be on the younger generation who simply don't have the means in any case. But I wanted to get a sense, just to tie this into our discussion here about the state of children in America, don't a lot of grandparents take care of kids?
Absolutely. In this country today, there are over 5 million grandchildren who are being raised in grandparent-headed households, and there are close to 1 million children who are being raised by grandparents without their own parents in the home. So, and I think it's particularly important to point out that the Social Security program provides critically important support for all children. 6.5 million children benefit from Social Security, but it also provides extra support to those children who are being raised specifically by their grandparents. So people forget that Social Security is a children's program as well as a program for seniors.
I'm speaking with Mary Lee Allen, who is Director of Child Welfare and Health at the Children's Defense Fund, and she is a co-author of the new report put out by the Children's Defense Fund, The State of America's Children 2011. Let's just go through some of the findings. As deeply troubling as they are, I think they're very important for the public to recognize that these are real statistics affecting real people and, most of all, affecting young and innocent and helpless children. The number of children living in poverty has increased by 4 million since 2000, and the number of children who fell into poverty between 2008 and 2009 was the largest single-year increase ever recorded. Where do we stand now?
I think certainly when you look at the 2009 data, and that is the most recent data we have, there will be updated statistics coming out in mid-September from the Census Bureau. But I think when you look at the fact that the child poverty increased just between 2008 and 2009 by 10%, which was the largest single-year increase since data was first collected. So I think we're all very concerned about what we're going to see a month from now when the 2010 data come forward. We have right now where every 32 seconds in our country, another child is born poor. And when you look at children of color, more than 1 in 3 Black and 1 in 3 Hispanic children are poor. So that gives you a sense of the special challenges. I think there's another very important point here about poverty. Almost half of all poor children live in extreme poverty, and that's at incomes of less than half of the poverty level. And to translate that, that's $30.10 a day for a family of four. So just imagine from your own personal situation that if you had all you had to raise four children for a family of four on was $30.10 a day, the challenges you'd be facing.
Another statistic, the number of homeless children in public schools increased 41% between 2006-2007 and 2008-2009 school years.
And certainly the number of homeless children, I think, is a very significant impact here as families are faced with foreclosures and end up on the street with their children. I think any of us could put ourselves in that situation and think of where would we go, where would we reach out, how would we get help. But that increase in the number of homeless children in schools, and that's a conservative measure because that's only the homeless children who are actually getting to school. And when you think about the number who aren't in one place long enough that they even get enrolled in school, that number is even higher.
Another statistic. In 2009, an average of 15.6 million children received food stamps monthly, a 65% increase over 10 years.
And certainly the number of children on food stamps has been increasing. There was just data released recently from this May that showed the significant increase, 45.7 million individuals living on food stamps. That's the highest number ever recorded. And I think what's particularly significant there is that for 37 straight months, that number has continued to increase. And that is the total number of individuals in America on food stamps. But roughly three quarters of those are in families with children. So it gives you a sense of what that's increased. It's increased for the last 3 years steadily each month as we move forward.
And again, I'm speaking with Mary Lee Allen, who is the Director of Child Welfare and Health at the Children's Defense Fund. We're talking about their recent report, The State of America's Children, 2011. Now, Mary Lee, obviously, if you have hungry and homeless children, they are not going to do well at school, or shall we say they're deeply disadvantaged. Another statistic, a majority of children in all racial groups and 79% or more of Black and Hispanic children in public schools cannot read or do math at grade level in the 4th, 8th, and 12th grades.
Certainly, when you look at these data, and I think they're really among the most striking, when you consider that children cannot read, children in public schools cannot read or do math at grade level, it's really a death sentence in this global economy where the ability to achieve is so significantly important. The fact that you cannot read and cannot compute by the time you graduate from high school really makes the prospects of future employment especially dim as we move forward.
And another statistic, the annual cost of center-based childcare for a four-year-old is more than the annual in-state tuition at a public four-year college in 33 states and the District of Columbia.
Certainly, the costs of childcare are challenges that families face across the spectrum of incomes, but particularly for families who lose their job but yet still have another parent working. The ability to get together the resources necessary to continue your child in childcare is so critically important. And I think we all know, too, the emotional impact on children that these times have, because not only do they sense the lack of stability in the home as parents are struggling with not having health care and not having employment, but they also then experience that instability as they have to be pulled from one child care provider to another.
So is there any talk at the federal level for addressing this crisis in child care? Because as we know, there's a lot of unemployment, but people who have employment for the longest time now, women have been working, they've had to work. So you have this situation where both parents are working and sometimes working several jobs.
And balancing the opportunity for child care. I know certainly the Children's Defense Fund has continued to push forward in terms of trying to see significant increases in availability of dollars, not only for child care, but for quality child care. And in some instances, this may be family child care, family daycare, but in more instances, it's trying to get children in quality center-based care that's so extremely significant. And we equate quality early childhood experiences with the issue of being ready for school and being able to start school ready to learn. And it moves us right into the whole area of education. I don't know that you know, but the fact that there are only 10 states that currently require, and these are that currently require by law, that all children get kindergarten. But yet, if you don't provide kindergarten to a child, they sort of start school with a half a step missing. They may go to kindergarten half day, and if they happen to have the money, they can go full day. So as CDF looks at the whole transition between early childhood and education, that kindergarten piece is particularly important as well.
But Mary Lee Allen, we've been largely addressing these terrible statistics in terms of what the federal government is not addressing or inadequately addressing. But it seems that already at the state level, this is where much of the damage is being done, because of the 47 states with newly enacted budgets, 38 or more of these states are making deep cuts in K-12 education, higher education, healthcare, and all of these are affecting the numbers of children who are both homeless and enrolled in public schools.
That's right. I think it's so important that we think of and we help educate our policymakers at the federal level, but also in states, to recognize that what we're talking about is a cascading disaster for these children, that the federal budget cuts that are being talked about will come on top of cuts that have already occurred, as you mentioned, at the state level and at the local level. When you look at programs that we know work, the Medicaid program and Children's Health Insurance Program for low-income children, the food stamp program, now called the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, critically important, and they're threatened with cuts that will then affect the state's ability to continue to move forward as well. And I think when you add these budget cuts to the stresses on families that have already occurred while family stability begins to deteriorate and lost jobs and reduced unemployment, you really beginning to get that sense that these things all topple one on top of another and frequently hit some of the very same families, the most vulnerable children and families who are left at risk as these services are cut back. For example, states have cut almost 600,000 jobs since 2008. So when you look at the ability of families to get the help they need in the states, if we lose federal dollars, that safety net is not there. That safety net has already become porous and been torn as we look ahead.
But surely, Mary Lee Allen, if we have millions of children in this country growing up under these terrible conditions where they're homeless and hungry and the numbers are growing, you would think that this is just the tip of the iceberg of what the cost that society pays. For a small investment in preventing this deprivation of young children, you prevent what happens later, I think, and it's probably, I imagine I'm correct in suggesting that kids that grow up under those terrible disadvantages who don't get a good education may well end up later in our jails, costing us more. Is that the pathology that you've noticed?
Well, and what the Children's Defense Fund describes that as the cradle-to-prison pipeline crisis facing children in our country. And this crisis really is at the intersection of poverty and race, because you have children who start out born at low birth weight. They don't get the quality early childhood experience that they need. They enter school, but they're not ready. So they are one of the 40% of children who drop out of school. They then become victim of abuse and neglect, may go into foster care, and move from there to the juvenile justice system, and too frequently from there to the adult criminal justice system. And at each stage, the cost of their care gets higher as we move forward. So certainly the need to invest early so that we can substitute that cradle-to-prison pipeline with a pathway to college and to productive employment and success for all children is the goal that we're working to achieve.
Well, Mary Lee Allen, you would think that there've got to be some billionaires out there who aren't paying their fair share of taxes that must realize that just to forego another home somewhere or another yacht would mean a better chance for millions of young kids in this country. And I guess hopefully there's some way that we can shame this society into doing the right thing.
Certainly, as we look forward, we have to protect children in low-income families from cuts. We have to invest in early childhood education, health, and mental health programs that we know will not only strengthen children, but the nation's economic future. But it's absolutely essential that we end tax breaks for millionaires and billionaires and close those tax loopholes for corporations as we move forward, because it's all about choices. The problems that we've described are not acts of God. They're choices that we've made as a public, as politicians, and we've got to change our choices and invest in children as we move ahead.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Mary Lee Allen.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Mary Lee Allen, who is Director of Child Welfare and Mental Health at the Children's Defense Fund. The Children's Defense Fund recently released their report, The State of America's Children, 2011. I'm Ian Masters. This has been Background Briefing. I would like to thank producer Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter and production intern Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting, and you can contact me at ianmasters.com. I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
Time.